this, well, even before I was elected, I was the district director for the Democratic Women, and that way I went to the state conventions and of particularly the Democratic Women. But I was, you know, getting into the mainstream of the Democratic Party.
Which would have been 75, 76.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess even before that, when I was district director, probably when Henry was on the city.
Yes.
I forget what the dates were. I think they thought it was fine to, but I don't think they emphasized, the party did not emphasize having women in high office. I worked hard for Margaret Harper when she ran for lieutenant governor. And she, you know, was quite a pioneer. And we went to rallies for her. Henry got excited about her and said, you know, we certainly ought to have a woman in high, we still don't, high office in this state. Never have had. I have no idea when it's going to be that we will have a woman in the Council of State or in the cabinet. I mean, of course we've had them in the cabinet. But lieutenant governor or governor, it's going to take a while in this state. And a woman, you know, one of the slogans in the women's movement is that women have to work twice as hard and be twice as good as men to get the same place men are. They said, fortunately, that's not hard. But it is hard because you can, and I also used to say, when people would say to me, oh, I'm so glad you're in office, I think we need more women in office, I used to say we need more qualified women. And I finally thought, to heck with qualified. But look at all the unqualified men who are running this world, and would let them, women qualified or not, have their shake too. So I don't care now whether they're qualified or not. I prefer them to be qualified.
I have a number of questions I want to ask about your specific legislative concerns.
Yes.
But let me ask this first. And you alluded in some measure to this already, but how do you think, subsequently, from your arrival there in the late 70s through to today, how have women's roles and the options available to them evolved in state politics? I mean, for example,
well,
in 91, you're chosen the first ever Speaker pro tem.
Yes. I think it has been a matter of degree of consciousness on the part of the men, and they see that we don't mess up, and we can do our jobs we comport ourselves well most of the time, and we do our homework. And really, I hear it a lot. Women do their homework, and you probably do too, Joe. There are very few women who, I mean, we just don't dare be unprepared or ill-informed if we try to get something done. I found when I first got there that, again, I'll go back to the old boy club. I remember there was just the top leadership in the Senate and the House, more in the Senate than in the House initially. I ended up calling them the fat jowls because they were, you know, I would sit there with my wonderful agenda, presenting it to the Senate Finance Committee or something, and I could see these old guys who just, you know, always chowing down at the receptions and everything, shaking their heads, those fat jowls going flap, flap, in the negative. And I just called them the fat jowls. And there just really was nothing you could do. I soon ruled out the idea of being just a maverick and just going against the system, because I wanted to get some things done, and there were some things that I had to just accept. My place in the scheme of things was one of them. I can remember when they were passing a law that said, we were first going into Clean Air Act, and so they had a bill in that said no local government can pass any legislation that would make tighter restrictions than the statewide. And I brought it up in the Joint Committee of Senate and House Appropriations, and I said, well, I said that's terrible. It was the state can't pass stronger laws than the federal laws. And I said, well, what about local places in this state? And I can remember the very senator who said, well, if they want cleaner air they in Buncombe County or something, they can just pass their own law and get cleaner air there. And I mean, that was the end of it. And I thought that was outrageous. But I knew that was the end of it. And that was called the Hardison Amendment. And it took. And it was Harold Hardison who said that, and I was brash enough in my freshman or my sophomore term there to say that, to get up and say it in the meeting. And so it probably took 10 years to repeal they called it the Handcuff Amendments and the Hardison Amendments, mostly to do with the environment.
Right.
That was exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And I don't mind saying that either.
Yeah. Can you describe your experiences as the first woman speaker pro tem? What are the most important aspects of that story that you could share?
Well, I mean, it was such a kind of a breakthrough, and a lot of people were very excited about it, and Dan Blue certainly went into it with the best of intentions. He and I kind of had a campaign going where I'd help him become speaker and he'd help me for speaker pro tem, and we kept saying, you know, wouldn't this just be mind-boggling, the first black speaker and the first woman speaker pro tem? And Dan was always courteous and somewhat inclusive of me, but I often had to remind him. I mean, I would see the chairman of all the major committees just sort of walking into his office and to the conference room, and I knew there was a meeting going on, and yet nobody had bothered to call me about it. And he would say, when I'd confront him, well, you certainly should come. And I'd say, well, I said, how did Martin Nesbitt find out about it across the street? Or George Miller, or whoever they were. And so lots of times I just would just go in, and he would say to me sometimes, you're always welcome to walk into my office, but I don't necessarily relish the idea of walking into an office with the door shut when the secretary is saying he's in conference. And sometimes I would just say, towards the end last year, I would just say, well, Lucille, I've got to see Dan, and let me just stick my head in there. And so Dan would say, come in. And then he would say to me later, you certainly can come into my office at any time. But I didn't. I mean, and the governor would be in there, or the president of the Senate, president pro tem of the Senate, and he would tell me, you're welcome at these meetings. But basically, they ignored me. They didn't often ask me what my opinion was. And I spent my first 2 years as speaker pro tem sitting in on these eyeball-to-eyeball final meetings when they were, you know, fighting over the final budget. Occasionally, I would say something, but, I don't know what they thought, but I wasn't aggressive. Now, maybe some women would have been more aggressive. Probably Carolyn Russell is. She's a very, you know, the current speaker pro tem. She just gets up and belts it out with them, and that's not my style. I had just expected that I would be there, but I will, in all fairness, say that I doubt if many speakers pro tem were brought into the loop. And I think Carolyn, and I had certainly hoped Carolyn would do a good job as the speaker pro tem. And I think what I kept saying in my 4 years in that office was that I wanted it not to be a novelty. I wanted it to just be a normal thing to happen, that we had women in these high things. And truly, we have now, to a certain extent. We still don't have a woman president pro tem in the Senate, or even a rules committee chairman, or, you know, the real gut committees. But we've come a long way. Not fast enough. Look at the states that have women governors, women lieutenant governors, women. We've had women in the Supreme Court. We've had Supreme Court justices, chief justice, that kind of thing. But I don't think we're certainly not on the cutting edge in North Carolina of promoting women. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind saying this to the Democrats. The Republicans, I think, have done even better. Because when they were not in charge, they still had women who were minority leaders or minority whips. We never did. And 1 year we tried to get a woman. When I was speaker pro tem, we were going to nominate a woman for majority leader. And boy, some of the men got wind of it and blew up. And one of them said to me, well, what do you want? Do you want to be the speaker pro tem, or do you want to have whoever she was, we were pushing to be majority whip, said, you're not going to get both. Now, I'll support you for Speaker Pro Tem, but if you're going to support her, I'll forget you. So, I mean, it was that blunt. It didn't matter that there were that many women. It didn't matter that we'd had all these centuries or decades of not having women in the leadership. We've promoted men, black men, in the leadership, I think, in the House more than we have women, basically.
Mm-hmm. But let me ask about some of your key legislative concerns in your years in Raleigh. And then I have a question. You were interested, as we've been talking earlier, about the daycare issue.
Yeah.
Interested about
child abuse.
Child welfare, infant mortality.
Yes.
You made repeated efforts to have corporal punishment in schools eliminated.
Yes. Didn't succeed. Completely.
Right. You supported the funding, the state abortion fund for poor women.
I opposed parental consent all these years. That's now law in North Carolina.
Right. Opposed the teen trial bill at the special criminal session.
Yes.
Pushed for environmental concerns.
Yes.
In a number of different ways. I'm also introduced a bill to repeal the sodomy law.
Yes.
So these are, you know, drawing these things up together, one can say that there's an element running through all of them that has to do in some ways with, one could probably argue, with gender, that these are a range of concerns that maybe have not traditionally been those at the front of the attention of men in the legislature.
Yeah, I think maybe that's true. One thing that one great big group I took on was the medical community. When I introduced first, I had a bill that was going to put a moratorium on the prohibition against any alternative medicine, which the Board of Medical Examiners had succeeded in doing, and they had run two very fine doctors out of Asheville who were practicing. One was practicing homeopathy, and one was practicing chelation, and they're both medical doctors, highly trained.
Excuse me one second. I'm just going to move this chair.
Introduced a bill. I was so incensed. I didn't even know these doctors, but I was so incensed at the arrogance of it and the denial of alternative medicine in this state on the stroke of the pen of the North Carolina Board of Medical Examiners. So I introduced a bill that would put a moratorium on prohibiting these types of medical practices. So they just exploded. And the medical community had always supported me. I got checks from their PACs every year. My great-grandfather founded the Medical Society of North Carolina. My brother's a doctor in Raleigh. So, I'm crazy about doctors. I have nothing to... I mean, I wasn't trying to get on their case. I was just trying to get them to get off the case of medical doctors who were going beyond traditional practice. And you know what the regulation said at that time? It said anything that is not... the word was not standard practice. It was more limited than that. I think it was something like not accepted practice. You know, just because it didn't suit them. And that they saw it as a threat. You know how the medical profession feels about chiropractors. And I've been pushing for chiropractors to get hospital privileges, admitting privileges, which they have in some states. As a result of that, we didn't succeed in the moratorium, but I turned it into a study commission, which is what you do when your bill's about to fail. And so I was co-chairman with Mary Seymour, the late Mary Seymour in the Senate. Did you ever know her, or you know of her probably? We co-chaired the study committee, and we came out with recommendations to the next session, which said that they could not do that. And so it turned out, as a result of that these doctors, the one who was run off practicing homeopathy, had got a letter in the last couple of years from the Board of Medical Examiners, and he's in Virginia, Charlottesville, has people 6 months on the waiting list to get into it. Inviting him back, said, you can come back, you can do whatever you want to. The burden of proof is now upon the medical board, not on the doctor. used to the doctor be, the doctor would have to say, well, I'm doing no harm. I can't, my patients are thriving. You know, I haven't killed anybody. I haven't crippled them. I haven't taken the wrong limb off or the wrong organ out or any of that. You know, they, it was, the burden of proof was on them. Now it's on the Board of Medical Examiners. And they, we've got a much bigger latitude here, much more latitude in our medical practice. We are now licensing acupuncturists, which we were not doing before. That, they didn't really outlaw acupuncture, but because we included it, we now license acupuncturists. And one of the acupuncturists here who had been treated so badly, the SBI went in and seized her records, her patient records, to, because the medical people said she was practicing medicine without a license. I mean, it's just so... SBI, I would have been in... I was infuriated. I didn't even know her. I know her now. She's on the board now that's the licensing board for acupuncturists. So that was a great victory, and yet it's not anything I got credit for, and that's okay. You know, they didn't call it the Colton Bill or something like that, but I was the one who braved the ire of and the fury of the medical profession, and it they were furious.
What led you to introduce the...
Sodomy?
Yeah, which is a gutsy political...
It just made me mad. It just made me mad. I mean, I can do whatever I want to. I'm a married woman. I can do the most bizarre sexual practices you can. Who knows what I do? But it's legal. But if in the privacy of my bedroom, and I don't know why adults can't do the same thing. They don't have to be legally married. They don't have to be homosexual. Or they don't have to be heterosexual. I think it's just outrageous, and particularly because it's administered so... in such a restrictive way against homosexuals. That's all it is. And one of my homosexual compatriots down there in the General Assembly went around very quietly lobbying the committee. And the bill went to the committee, said, please don't let that bill get out of committee. And people were so surprised. They had thought he, of all people, would probably approve of it because he was a very open homosexual. And my analysis of it was that he didn't want to have to go on record as voting, because he probably would have voted against it, because the people in his home district might not know of his boyfriend in Raleigh. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I worked with the homosexuals. I worked with the group from Chapel Hill, the gay and lesbian rights, whoever they were, and they ruined it, and I'll tell you how. Is this germane to what
we
said? They came to the committee meeting, the second meeting we had, there was some women, Annie Kennedy, and there was some, they put off the vote. I got enough support to put it off, and then we had another, we were going to have a public hearing, and much to my dismay, there were some people in the audience who had not conferred with me at all, who wanted to speak, and who did get up and speak, and they were, I mean, it was just perfectly obvious that they were homosexual, men and women, and they got up and they just killed it right there. Because that was one of the men on the committee had said, this is just a bill for homosexuals. We don't want those kind of people. Those kind of people. So, I mean, here,
do you think you could have got this out of committee? Because I know in the first vote it was 6-6, as I recall.
Yeah.
So you think you could have got it out of committee?
If it hadn't, I don't know, because Bobby Hunter, who was the chairman of the committee, called it up. He just leapfrogged every other bill in his committee and called it up 2 days later. And in the normal course of things, it would have been months before that bill came up. But he wanted to get it up and down in a hurry. He didn't want all the... People just didn't want to be on record as voting one way or another about that. And I think it's regrettable because no matter how one feels about that lifestyle or the way people... I'm convinced they're born that way. And I've got some good friends who are, you know, practicing homosexuals in a nice union. A friend of mine, his daughter, has a partner, and she herself, the daughter, has been the one who's had two children in the family, and the my friend goes up when they have these babies and helps, and someone was telling me yesterday about a good friend of hers who's done exactly the same thing. And my cousin has a homosexual son, and big deal, you know. But we've got this wretched Christian, and I don't even like to use the term. I think it's outrageous that we have allowed them to usurp Christian as uniquely theirs, the right-wing Christian movement, because I consider I'm as good a Christian as they are. I don't care whether you're Christian or not. I don't think that's relevant. But the Christian community has just kind of caved in on that without even understanding what's happened to them. Where I'm working with a group here that is trying to fight back. It's,
how effective has the Christian right been in North Carolina? How influential across your state?
I think you can look at the legislature right now. And I think it's been pretty effective. And look at Robin Hayes. It's to me, it's scary. I think it'll pass. I think we may go through some very repressive times. And I think it's a cyclical thing that happens. And when women get too uppity, or such groups as homosexuals, then there's always an upsurge. And you can look at the Salem witches. You can look at what's happened. You can forever in history. You can look at when the women get too much in control, the guys can't take it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about while we're talking about some of these cultural issues.
I'm including the Pope in this too.
Let me ask about certain related issues. What do you recall of the ERA fight across? Well, I guess there were six different votes on ERA in North Carolina from what, the 73 or something through 82. What were your impressions watching that unfold?
Well, I went to Raleigh once before I was elected to go with a group that was down there trying to get the passage of the ERA. And when you get in there and you see these angry groups with their signs, ERA no, ERA yes, and all of them with their little thing on, or whatever the issue is, abortion. I've seen it, capital punishment. I've seen it so many times from the inside, mostly, but I certainly was in favor of the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, and it was a very touchy thing in campaigning. And I remember when we had it was considered so outrageous and so sinful to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, because you remember all the things they said it would bring about. And so when I got there, the issue was still very much alive, and that was the year that the Senate leadership very quietly called in enough senators and said, "Now we will not bring this up for a vote this year." So I've never had a chance to vote on it.
Let me ask them.
And I've had some effect on, we reworded a lot of our state laws. I put in a bill one time, for instance, too, to change firemen to firefighters. In all that section of the law. And then I did one on master servant, which was the labor, I forget which section of the statutes it's in, but it's employer employee now, because I put that in. But I thought that again was very offensive and very degrading, and it was in all the books, master servant. And I don't think the women in my husband's office appreciate it. Master servant. The masters are men down there, and the servants are women. But I don't think they would like to be classified that way. There was a woman who was an owner of that company, co-owner, and she got married and moved away. So that we lost that. My husband's small company.
I need to get down the mountain here in another 15 minutes.
Okay.
Or so that's the only reason I'm moving.
Okay.
More speed than I would really prefer.
But the ERA was a very touchy issue, and socially, when we'd go out, people, if it would come up, people would get in heated arguments, my friends. It's interesting, because the friends that I've had in a lot of places who've not, my childhood friends, my lifelong friends, some of them have moved along with the times, and others haven't, and they're just... Some of my friends say to me that they, one after another of their friends, and oftentimes they're my friends, have just ruled out certain areas for conversation. You just can't talk about them. You can't talk about blacks. You can't talk about homosexuality. You can't talk about equal rights. It's just abortion. I've got friends. My next door neighbor right here is a good friend of mine, very close friend. He's so hung up about abortion, you won't believe it. And she's all for this sex respect stuff and abstinence until you're married. And I can tell you from having seen her children growing up in this neighborhood, she missed the mark there. And I will one day remind her of that. I know her children.
I want to ask a series of questions about the Republican Party's recent success.
All
get
right.
your views on that.
Okay.
What do you think, taking all of this, all these developments into consideration, can you give me your broadest perspective on what it really explains? Are there certain factors you can point to that really get to the heart of the Republican Party's recent success?
I think a lot of it is what I was just talking about. Some people cannot handle change. They don't understand what's happening in the world. The societies are coming unraveled. The culture is coming unraveled, and they don't understand it. There's no authority, like parent to child. There's no. I think one of the things that's very interesting is I was in my doctor's office just last week getting for my annual checkup, and most of them are women in this firm, and I went to make an appointment for something else that had another test, and the little girl, she looked like she was in high school at the window making an appointment, says, well, let me go ask Karen when she can do this. And I thought, Karen is the doctor, you know, who would, I mean, it used to be they'd practically genuflect when they said, let me go ask Dr. Dedman when it's convenient, but she said, I'll go ask Karen. 18-year-old or something. But more than that, I think people have been manipulated by probably the media and the Pat Buchanans and the Perots and all, to where they feel so threatened. They feel threatened by immigrants. They feel threatened by homosexuals. They feel threatened by blacks, by disease. They feel threatened by with the economy. And all you have to do is make somebody look bad. And the Democratic Party reminds me of the Episcopal Church, of which I'm a lifelong member and many generations of my family. Inclusive. We have services for the homosexuals. We blessed our animals down here at our church last Saturday. We include all kinds of people, men and women, although I'm not saying the Episcopal Church is that outstanding, but we... Just like the Democratic Party, we take care of the poor people. We include them. We take care of the blacks. We include the homosexuals. In the process, we shoot ourselves in the foot with the public, because those are the hot button issues. People are scared to death. Why? I mean, seriously, I don't know why this homosexuality is such a threat to people. Do you, Joe? Do you sense it?
Oh, sure. People are.
And I think this country has gotten so racist. It's gotten so homophobic. I've seen a real shift, backward shift. And I think people feel threatened, and somebody is now out there manipulating with the media and pornography. They're so afraid their kid's gonna get a hold of pornography. My joke is that I don't have any pornographic materials. I don't even have a pornograph. I think that's what it is. Yeah. I don't know what else. Yeah.
When did you first?
The standard of living is threatened, and the poor people are not going to take it much longer. I don't think. I think we're getting to a place of real, real confrontation in this country, and it's going to be class warfare. I really do. I think the money that this unprecedented transfer of money that's taking place is obscene, immoral, outrageous, unfair. Our church has had a one-day workshop on how much is enough and trying to look at lifestyles and say, you know, I mean, my husband and I say, do we need this big six-bedroom house? Well, it's not. I mean, we're not offending anybody with a house. What would we do with it? But we don't. I use it. I use every inch of it. But with the children gone and coming back rarely, with seven grandchildren, it's you know, it's the kind of house we kind of want to keep for our own pleasure and our children to enjoy. But, and I don't think it doesn't take a lot of maintenance, but if I had a mansion somewhere that required enormous expenditure of money that I could be giving or sharing, I would feel, I think I might feel more guilty. I mean, obviously we all live better than we have to, but we don't own another house. We own two Taurus cars. You know, my husband does the yard work. I don't consider that we live a very outrageous lifestyle, but a lot of people do that I know. I have friends who have three or four houses, travel around. I don't know how they remember where their good shoes are.
When did you first feel the political ground shifting significantly in North Carolina politics? And do you think the Democrats' party anticipated this turn?
No, I don't think they did. I don't think they did nationally or statewide. Should I talk louder? I heard in my last term that people were getting fed up with Dan Blue. Not per se Dan, but because he was giving the blacks so much influence in the legislature, and a lot of people resented it, and they were saying to me,
a lot of members resented it.
People outside the legislature primarily were saying, maybe some people in the legislature did too, but the people outside saw it as a more control by the blacks, and without understanding that the blacks have been so underrepresented and so out of the loop. And I think that explains a lot of the reaction to the OJ trial. If I were a black, I might have said, in my heart, I think he's guilty, but when does a black man who murders a white woman get exonerated? I think he's guilty, but I do think that explains a lot of that. I have some sympathy, a lot of sympathy with the Million Man March. I hope it produces good results. And some of our friends who would have been inclined, I think, to pick up and make some awfully ugly remarks about it. We've just kind of headed them off at the pass.
Let me ask you finally here. You spent 16 years in Raleigh, so you had a good long look at the way the system functions over there. What can you say ultimately about the actual functioning character of state government in North Carolina? Does it function the way it should, or does it have certain fundamental strengths or fundamental weaknesses? Is it not your model of how a state system ought to function?
It doesn't fit my model of how I would like to see it function. And I say a good bit, if I were in charge, I said it when I was in the legislature, if I were in charge, we'd do some things differently. If I were governor, I would do some things differently. I think, I don't know whether it's just inevitable and built into all systems that there's always a power structure. I think John Q. Public is not represented there. John Q. Public pays his taxes, and so does Jane Public pay their taxes. They go to the polls, they vote, they might not be active in politics, but they try to inform themselves. I'm thinking of just conscientious people who are serious about elections go and they vote for somebody, and then they think, I've elected Mary Colton, she's going to go down there and look out for me. And truly, a lot of the members don't. They are elected by the bankers or the lawyers or the school teachers or the whoever. No judgment on any of those groups, but John Q. Public doesn't have a pinstripe suited lobbyist there just saying, I represent John and Jane Public. And I think that's a shame. And I think, and I am now, as you saw, I'm now on the National Governing Board of Common Cause, and that is an extension of what I was trying to do in the legislature, to make government more equitable, to get the money out of it. And until we can control this outrageous money stream that is going into elections and going into the political process, we're not going to get any reforms. You can forget term limits, you can forget anything. Money is what it is, and all you have to do is just look at what's happened to the Republican freshmen in Congress who went there on a reform ticket. They have raised this term, 6 months into their first term, they have raised, I don't know what the difference is over what the incoming freshmen raised from the PACs 2 years ago, but it is significant. It's millions more. And what are they doing with it? Getting themselves dug in. They're digging in, entrenching themselves.
And I would love to see, I tried to get some very strict limits on what could be spent in campaigns, who could spend it, what had to be public information, and I'm going to continue that with Common Cause, and I believe it very, very strongly. I was talking to an Englishman about it the other day, and he said, you know, we don't spend money on our campaigns. He said, I just can't believe what I see going on here. It's not done that way. Now, he may be naive. He may not see that some of the MPs are getting money slipped to them under the table. I'm not convinced that any system is free of that kind of influence. But I think in our system it is, it's just completely out of hand. And therefore, I don't think government works the way it ought to, nationally or state or even locally. Jim Hunt, and Jim Hunt's a friend of mine, I support Jim Hunt, Bill Clinton the same way, but they must take money because the campaigns cost so much money. And what do you do when you take money? You owe somebody something. And I've just been reading a book by Walter Scott called Quentin Durwood. Was rereading it. It's a marvelous, marvelous book. Louis the 11th. And he was, Quentin Durwood was this idealistic young Scot who came over to be a kind of a soldier of fortune, and he's just joined the elite Scottish Guard there in the French court. And he said he looked at the closest advisors of the king, and he said they were I read it out loud to Henry last night because it was so delicious. It said they look like men who, not that they're not smart, but their previous experience would not have accustomed them to moving in such circles. Or, you know, it was just, they were roughnecks is what they were. And that's why you see these appointments that are made by governors, by presidents, by mayors, whoever, because somebody owes somebody something. And I don't think our government is working the way it was intended to work. And we've got masses of people. Look at the people with no health insurance. And look at the big interest groups with money who are seeing to it that they don't get insurance. It's obscene. I saw where Castro was offering medical service to poor Americans. Did you see that?
I didn't hear that. I knew it's
been made up. So, I don't think I'm very modest. I'm sorry, Joe. But
reluctant that I have to...
Have I answered enough, given you enough material?
Extremely helpful. And I know that we could profitably spend hours more because we have so much to say and so much that needs to be in the record. So thank you very much for
Well, I enjoyed it. I'm flattered that you wanted to talk to me.